I'd like now to welcome back to the show Lois Rudnick. She is Professor Emerita of American Studies from the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. A pleasure to be here.
So we are here to talk about Charlie Chaplin. The film Modern Times is going to be screened at the CCA three times in the next several days, December 29th and 30th, and then again on January 2nd. And you are going to be doing an introduction and Q&A, and it's part of this whole Charlie Chaplin Holiday Festival that has been going on at the CCA. Now, Modern Times, tell us about this movie and why it is still as important as it is. I mean, it was made in 1936.
Yes, it was. Let me just say that I'll be doing the intro and Q&A just on January 2nd at 6 o'clock at that showing.
Okay, good.
Modern Times, I think, is as relevant to the state of our country, our nation today, as it was when it was made in 1936, because it's dealing with themes that have not gone away. Granted, it was made during the Great Depression, the time when we had the largest number of people unemployed and underemployed in this country. As President Roosevelt said, one-third ill-fed, ill-housed, and I guess ill-jobbed, if that's a verb. But Charlie is dealing with not just issues of economic insecurity, hunger, starvation, not just hunger, class oppression, the speed up of industrial technology that was dehumanizing to workers then and can still be dehumanizing to workers now, as we know, oftentimes offshore in factories and industries that Americans don't know very much about or see anymore. He's dealing with issues of gender roles, of what's appropriate for male-female behavior, and he's dealing with issues of class in a way that are profoundly interesting and still relevant to issues of social inequality in this country.
And all the while, it's still hilarious.
It is absolutely hilarious. I want to quote you something from the Museum of Modern Art website about Chaplin. Chaplin, they say, remains the most universally recognized fictional image of a human being in the history of art. He was, in his time, and at the height of his career in the teens and 20s and 30s, the single most beloved comic actor in the world. This was particularly true before sound came into movies. And we can talk a lot more about this, but just briefly I'll say one of the reasons that Chaplin waited 9 years before introducing sound into his movies. The first sound pictures were made in 1927. Modern Times does have sound, but in a very peculiar, or in many peculiar kinds of ways.
Right.
There's no real human voice that isn't mediated through a machine in the movie until the end, when he sings his hilarious, what is sometimes called mock Italian gibberish song that people laugh hilariously at in the bar but can't understand a word of.
And he's forgotten the lyrics.
He's forgotten the lyrics.
And so he sings fake Italian.
But it's his I don't think there was ever a more brilliant mime actor than Charlie Chaplin. I think many film historians would agree with me. And why people laugh uproariously is because he communicates with his body and his facial gestures in a way that he is suggesting language is too dishonest to do. A friend of mine who wrote a wonderful article about Chaplin many years ago said that language does everything in modern times except communicate. And his fear of leaving the silent film industry and moving into sound was manifold. One of the major reasons was that he was a universal figure and loved all over the world. In France and Russia, everywhere his films were shown, all of the time, was that he could communicate universally across language. Immigrants loved him. If they couldn't barely speak English when they came to the U.S., they had no difficulty understanding his gestures. He did a wonderful film in 1916 called The Immigrant, which better than anything at that time, certainly, and much later, encapsulated the experience of coming here in steerage, what it was like to be stopped at Ellis Island by bureaucrats, what it was like to be treated like basically stuff in the, not a person, but a commodity. And he captures the fear and the joy and the wonder of immigration just brilliantly in that small film. But he felt he would lose a good deal of his audience if he began to speak. He felt it would impede his improvisatory work that he did, because a lot of what he does is what came to him as he was doing it. It wasn't necessarily scripted ahead of time. And when I read about that, I was fascinated by it, because we think of silent film as people growing up with sound film as in some ways off-putting, having to read those little scripts. But in many ways, it could communicate in a way that sound film has to be translated or dubbed or whatever that isn't quite the same. And he spoke for the little man, you know, the man at the lowest end of the economic social totem pole everywhere in the world at that time that he was living in. And he was adored for it.
And he was very little. I mean,
he was 5'4".
Yeah.
And at his best weight, 130 pounds.
Right. And so he was this little guy, and he played the character of the little tramp. And one of the things that I was reading about it was that his unwillingness to go into sound had everything to do with the development of that character, the little tramp.
Yes.
With the big shoes who walked so oddly.
Indeed.
Because that character, first of all, was universal, but also the nature of that character was to communicate through gesture.
Absolutely. And he felt there was an honesty about gesture and miming that was impossible with language, especially in a world where people that he represented, the little man in the of whatever ethnic, national origin, whatever, was being crushed by an industrial system of capitalism that made it impossible for him to be seen as a full human being with an imagination, with a soul, with a heart. And if you notice, he often juxtaposes a little tramp with a very large, often beefy kind of counterpoint male figure who's oppressive, a police figure, a boss, so that he's making fun of, in some ways, our notion that the bigger you are, the smarter you are, the better you are, and sort of, again, standing up for the little man metaphorically and also literally.
We're talking to Lois Rudnick. It's interesting because it's a kind of hybrid silent film and sound film.
Yep.
In the sense that it's not, you couldn't do it with some person playing a piano in the theater. It's
right.
Not about that.
No.
The sound is very much synced to the movie. And at the beginning, you have Charlie Chaplin working, or the little tramp working in a factory. And there's some kind of almost 1984-like Big Brother.
Yes.
Who is the boss on a screen wherever he goes. If he goes to the men's room,
right.
If he's telling him to work faster or to stop smoking. Or
right. This actually, the genesis for this film came from a tour that Chaplin was given by Henry and Edsel Ford of the Ford factory in the 19-teens at some point. And what Ford was renowned for, of course, was for using the assembly, for taking the assembly line and figuring out ways to rationalize and specialize labor on it such that by 1925... he could produce, or his workers could produce, one tin Lizzie, as they were called, the black Ford car, every 30 seconds. Now, this meant taking labor, de-skilling it, to the point where each worker in the assembly line, as Charlie brilliantly parodies in the beginning of this movie, is given one job. And by one discrete job, I mean they may put a bolt and a nut on something. It's then sent to the next person, who is the person who makes sure that the bolt and nut are tightened properly, and then on. Charlie saw men who were doing these kinds of labor, which viscerally created all kinds of physical problems that he demonstrates in what happens to his body when he starts to have his nervous breakdown. For 9 hours a day, initially Ford didn't have much competition. He became one of the wealthiest men in the world. But when other car companies started competing with him, some of the goodies that he offered his workers, $5 a day wages for those who were more highly skilled, company housing and other things, began to disappear. And he began to adopt some of the principles of an American engineer, Frederick Winslow Taylor, who is considered to be the father of time motion studies, and he called his program scientific management. And the idea was is that all of the thought processes that go into labor, and which certainly go into labor for people who are artisans and craftspeople, should be taken away from workers who are not really intelligent enough to think anyway, many of them being immigrants, of course, and given to their supervisors so that they wouldn't have to think. They would just be told what to do. By the 1920s, they could not take bathroom breaks or water breaks without permission. So that scene in Modern Times where Charlie sneaks into the bathroom to have a cigarette and Big Brother comes on the screen and tells him to get back to work, that was really happening in those plants in the 1920s. And Chaplin was told that by somebody at the plant, a worker, that farm boys off the farm within 4 or 5 years were so, their bodies were so devastated by the pace of the work and by the dehumanization of the work that many of them really did have. Some of them had mile breakdowns. Some of them had to leave. There was a huge turnover, 380% a year turnover in the 20s in Ford's factories.
And meanwhile, you've got Charlie Chaplin parodying this because he's tightening the bolts on some little piece on the assembly line, and he starts tightening everything that looks like a bolt, whether it be a woman's button on her dress.
Or on her butts, or on her boobs.
Right.
And he, when he breaks down, when the machine breaks him down, he is swallowed by the machine, which is one of the, probably the most famous image in the film, as he is taken through the machine. It's like looking, and he was beloved by the avant-garde, particularly in French. It looks like it could be a precisionist photograph or painting.
He goes through the gears, sort of twisting and turning.
Exactly. And when he comes out, he does this incredibly, I mean, he's crazed. And he does this kind of monkey wrench gang, manic dance.
Like a little ballet.
A little ballet in which he is both honoring Nijinsky, who loved him and said, "Your comedy is balletic," Nijinsky told him in 1916. And he loved The Afternoon of a Faun, which is a very sensual, sensual movie about the awakening of a young faun who falls in love with a nymph. And when he picks up those wrenches and puts them over his ears and starts to leer at the women, that attractive secretary, he's really kind of mimicking or making an homage to Nijinsky's famous dance. Fernand Léger made a film called Ballet Mécanique in 1924, in which Charlie is kind of a cubist. He's presented as a kind of cubist figure at the beginning, and he has all the gears and gearworks dancing. So he was both a kind of social realist, you know, showing the real pains and horrors of the Great Depression for those who were poor and without home, and also a modernist, brilliant modernist artist who's using montage techniques and abstraction techniques and surrealist and futuristic techniques to make fun of some of the things that some of these artists revered, the dehumanizing nature of the machine, rather than the way in which it helped to capacitate human beings, which it also did as well.
We're talking to historian Lois Rudnick. So do we know what Charlie Chaplin's own political leanings were?
Well, his political leanings are very controversial, and they are inconsistent. He loved to quote Walt Whitman, who said, "If I contradict myself, I contradict myself. I contain multitudes." In the cultural crit business, we would say that Charlie Chaplin was a multivalent kind of symbol who stood for many things sometimes that were sometimes contradictory. So he was definitely a supporter of the New Deal. There are some people who claim he was a communist, as many people who know about his life know. In 1952, he was essentially banned from this country during the Cold War, McCarthy era.
But who wasn't?
Many people were. I mean, he certainly was left-leaning in the sense that he believed wealth should be redistributed. But he also had a strong anarchist streak. And he was, as you can tell from this movie, there isn't a single institution that society reveres or cherishes that he does not savage in modern times. The prison system, religious people who go and pretend they're going to teach God and reform those who have committed crimes. The social service system that tries to take away the gamin, Paulette's sisters when her father is killed in a strike. I mean, he's not even, part of the strike. He's shot and killed, and they are left homeless. The industrial system. So at the same time, he believed in redistribution of wealth and in the dangers, what Mark uses very kind of Marxist perceptions and critiques of how men are being turned into machines by the, and not having any kind of connection really to the process, a product of their labor, if they're unskilled assembly line workers. He thinks government is dangerous, and he doesn't, I don't think he ever quite understood that it was impossible to make the kinds of changes he believed in without having the kind of government intervention that we had under Roosevelt. And he did admire Roosevelt. So there are a lot of contradictory elements to him. I would say he was a progressive anarchist, if I had to give him a name, but he would not want to be named as such politically.
Right. And it's so interesting to me because that kind of dehumanization has only grown, and it's grown in different ways that I don't think even Charlie Chaplin could even have predicted. I remember talking to a friend of mine who, when she was in high school, worked at one of those chain pizza restaurants, which I shall not name right now. But she basically said, the thing is organized, this restaurant is organized in such a way that it can be run perfectly by a small group of stoned teenagers.
That's you can thank Frederick Winslow Taylor for that.
And she basically said that if you are smart and ambitious and creative and have some energy, it will kill you to work there. And she was, this particular person said, it basically encourages stonage among teenagers because it's so mind-numbing to work there.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about what work was before the Industrial Revolution, and particularly for so-called unskilled laborers, workers who worked in small factories or in their own individual workshops, who were tin makers or barrel makers or whatever it is, weavers, had total control of the production, how they would cost things, the pace of their work, and could take and had to do all of it, from beginning to end, for the most part, until some things became available more easily that they could take, like wool and dyed wool. But it was mental and physical labor. And it was something that, a craft of which they could be proud. What is so horrific about the de-skilling of labor that has gone on throughout most of the 20th century, really starting in the late 19th century, but hepped up enormously with the Ford automated factory system, and that went all international, all over the world, was adopted by industries, is that you are turning people into automatons. And one of the amazing things about this film that Chaplin really understands is that the things, the bolts, the nuts, the parts that make the Tin Lizzies, or in this case he's in a steel factory, have an aliveness because they're moving all the time. The gears are moving, the wheels are moving. The men are static and immobilized except for doing the little one thing they're doing with their widgets.
And so
you reverse the human and the inhuman, the organic and the material worlds. And he just represents that brilliantly in the film.
And I'm watching it thinking carpal tunnel syndrome.
Yeah, no kidding. You have to. We think that is, a modern product of people working on computers, but there had to have been serious physical disabilities, as well, we know there were.
Well, it's called modern times.
Modern times, exactly. That's how he views modern times.
Let's talk about the movie and about the comedy. I mean, one of the things about the film is that the whole thing looks like it's speeded up. But I think it was shot at a 1 frames per second and then shown at a slightly faster number of frames per second. And so everybody is running and moving faster than they possibly could in real life.
Exactly. Now, he's one of the ways in which he parodies the assembly line system and the speed up that was involved in the, part of Fordism and Taylorism, as they were called, was trying to get the human being to work at the fastest pace he could possibly work without doing damage. And he's showing the utter absurdity of it by making people work much faster than you ever could have on any assembly line in the world. And if I could just tell you a very quick anecdote about my dad, because this is so poignant, I think, and relevant to this part of the film. Charlie Chaplin was my father's favorite comic actor, and Modern Times was his favorite Chaplin film. He had joined, after he'd worked in a steel mill and seen the death of several workers, mostly African-American, who worked the most dangerous jobs, he came back from Illinois after 3 months, and at some point soon thereafter joined the Communist Party. He later became a progressive in the 1940s and an Adlai Stevenson Democrat in the 1950s. But he began the Industrial Engineering Department at Northeastern University. And to make extra money, because he was so poorly paid, he worked for a large Malden factory called Malden Mills, the owner of whom was profoundly in love with time motion studies. And he hired my dad to do a time motion study of the assembly line workers. And my dad came home, and I remember saying he was just grinning from ear to ear. And I said, "Dad, how could you do this? Doesn't this kind of go against what you believe in?" He said, "Well, when I showed the film to the owner of the mill, I speeded it up so it looked like the workers were working faster than he could ever imagine them doing anything more." And he was thrilled. I said, I said, the same kind of subversion that Charlie Chaplin uses in Modern Times. It was just wonderful.
Now, wait a minute. So he showed it, speeded up. So wouldn't that make the head of the company want them, think that that was the baseline and make them want to work faster?
He was so, just as the audience starts to laugh hysterically, as Charlie speeds up the film and speeds up the line, that's the owner was just flabbergasted by how hard his workers were working. I mean, who knows how long it lasted. He was just pleased. Who knows how long that lasted? But the problem was is that often these measurements of what a normal human being could do without injury were based on the toughest, strongest workers who were not, by any stretch of the imagination, the norm in a factory or on an assembly line. And
so that'd be like setting the norm on the track team as the fastest person.
Exactly. That's basically the Taylorite system. He would pick somebody at the Bethlehem Steel Company who worked 12 hours a day and ran back and forth a mile to his house and say, "Would you like to make a little more money?" And workers were paid more. But the disproportion between their increase in wages for producing more and what the stockholders and CEOs got was gargantuan, maybe not as gargantuan as it is today.
It probably was, because after the New Deal, those numbers, those ratios decreased.
They did.
And then they started increasing again.
Exactly.
We're talking to Lois Rudnick. So back to the comedy.
I
mean, what happens is when you start watching this movie, I mean, every single scene, something Chaplin's going to mess it up or something's going to go horribly wrong. And so at a certain point, you're just waiting, okay, how's it going to go?
Exactly.
Bonkers now.
Well, he was, I think, the greatest master of comedy of his generation. And one of the things, and some of these tricks are as basic as can be, the essence of comedy is incongruity. A brilliant writer about humor once wrote, that is, what you expect is not what you get. And his wearing this tiny bowler that doesn't fit his head, a kind of down and out, it looks like it could be a tuxedo, but it's ill-fitting, clown shoes that are five sizes too big, a cane, and never being able to walk in a straight line. He's always walking with duck feet, quite wide open. That, he's trying to pretend that he's a gentleman. He's clearly, a hobo. He's a little tramp. He's at the bottom of the, social hierarchy. But his manners are always absolutely impeccable. So, you might remember, people might have seen Gold Rush, and there's this fabulous scene where he's starving to death, and he decides he's going to eat a boot. He puts down a napkin. He takes out his knife and fork. Delicately, he carves the boot. So this juxtaposition between wanting to be seen as a dignified human being worthy of being valued and the insanity of the situation in which he finds himself. And his, with these, very basic kind of humor techniques that he can carry sort of to a place where very few people could, because of the unbelievable flexibility and grace of his body, he is able to show, he's able to use a tiny man's body against huge forces of industrial, economic, and social oppression, and manage to make it just completely chaotic. I mean, he never ultimately wins, but he upends every situation in which he's in. Even though he seems like he's going to be caught, he's put in jail. He gets to jail. He ends up taking, as we know, snorting some cocaine without realizing it. And that gives him the courage to to stop a jailbreak, and he becomes a good friend of the jailer. And there's this wonderful moment that I hope everybody will notice where he's sitting in jail reading the newspaper. Birds are chirping. There's a picture of Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
And he's reading. You see the headline, strikes, hunger, and he's going... And then the head of the prison says, well, we're letting you go. And he says, why? I don't want to leave.
Yeah.
When prison becomes the safest place for a human being to be, the only place he can get food, and it's 3 square meals a day, it really calls into question, but in a very funny way, what is wrong with the society we're living in? And humor makes it much easier to take that kind of social critique.
I think there's something also that's very important to note, which is that when times are bad, people really don't want to watch documentaries about how horrible
right.
those very times are.
Exactly. In fact, some of the most popular movies of the 1930s were escapist movies, like the Gold Digger movies, where, you know, you had these fabulous fantasies of beautiful Corrines dressed in incredible costumes doing wonderful dances. And for some of the people on the left who've criticized modern times for sort of not having a program for how to deal with the problems that he presents in the film, I would say most people did not want to see workers shot. Most people who went to the movies did not want to see the misery in which they were living on their misery in which they knew others were living. And he's able to present it really harshly at the same time that there's always an underlying humor. There's always a way in which he and Paulette can escape. And the ingenuity and imagination that he brings to being a free human being, to, you know, forestalling the forces that just want to crush all the humanity out of him and other people like him who don't count for anything in society, is absolutely life-affirming and wonderful for an audience to see, I think.
And it also, at least as I was watching it, brings up the reality that we're still living with, which is that nobody wants to be part of the dehumanized workforce.
Right.
But everybody wants the products
exactly.
that come out of the dehumanized workforce.
I think one of the great scenes in the movie about that, which is easy to miss, is when he and Paulette are working. He's working as a night watchman in the department store, and he gets drunk for reasons you'll see when you see the movie, and he ends up sleeping under a pile of clothes. A consumer comes into the store in the morning when it opens up at 9:30 and starts pulling what she thinks is some cloth that she might want to buy, and it's his shirt. And one of the points that I think Chaplin is making there is something that happened very early on in sort of the industrialization of America. Originally, department stores had workers in the windows. So you could see the people who were making the very things that you were going in to buy. And by the late 19th century, department stores had their workers in factories where they were never seen, and beautiful lit, they started using lighted displays so that everything that is bought, and this is true of supermarkets where everything's wrapped for us, you never have to think about the human labor that picked your crops, your lettuce, or the human labor that made your handbag, or the one penny that some kid in Thailand is being paid to make your jeans, or the 10 pennies that are being paid and incarcerated sometimes in factories. Cutting off the product that the consumer buys and can buy for less because of lower wages and speed up and all the rest of it means that you can be a guilt-free shopper. Unless, of course, you're paying attention to the way that the entire way in which the product in which you're buying, where it comes from, who's doing the labor. Very few people ask that question. And so her disgust with picking up Charlie Chaplin by his undershirt is really a kind emblematic of the fact that workers are not labor is not supposed to be present where consumers are buying their things.
Right. We're talking to historian Lois Rudnick. And, I mean, I think the time that we're living in now underscores the reality that even when you do know what's going on, and even when you feel the kind of guilt and pain and borderline panic about it that comes now with the fact that doing everything that started in the 19th century in modern times is changing our climate and melting every last piece of ice mm-hmm. on the earth, apparently,
mm-hmm.
and we're still giving each other technology and things like right. that for Christmas. And
I think Charlie, if he were to make that film today, he would use social media. I mean, he would have people on their laptops and their iPods, you know, and their iPhones, and he would probably show you the workers in the factories that are offshore who are making these things for how many hours a day at very low pay. And then, of course, he would show you that human beings are walking by and maybe there are, you know, dead bodies in front of you, but you're so attached to your, you're so attached to texting that you can't pay any attention to your world. He would get it completely.
Right.
There are film historians who claim that Chaplin is really the kind of forebear of the post-apocalyptic movies of the late 20th century and early 21st century, like Blade Runner. You know, worlds that have been completely taken over by machines, in which people are cyborgs, and in which there is very limited human freedom, if any freedom at all. And I think you can make that claim for this film.
On a completely different note, in addition to being a comic genius, he wrote the music, and there's this song which was familiar to me, and I realized it was the song Smile, Though Your Heart
yes,
is Breaking.
Yes, he wrote that.
He wrote that, and then later, because I had to look it up, because I was like, what's going on here? Somebody else actually put lyrics to it, but he composed that song and all yep. the music in the movie.
He was a control freak.
Which is a not very nice way of saying multi-talented.
No, in the sense that, I mean, there are sides to Charlie Chaplin as a man and a director that could drive people crazy. He had a lot of anger. He liked to control. He was the director. He was one of the few Hollywood stars who had full control over his complete operation, directing, producing, acting, who he was going to hire. He wrote the music. And I think it's he. This is a figure. This little tramp figure was alive and in the films for 20 years. His last hurrah is Modern Times. He doesn't show up again ever.
As the tramp.
As the tramp. No, he shows up as a speaking person in different kinds of characters that he plays.
And he was in his late 40s yeah. then, and as agile as can possibly be.
Well, I hope you noticed he did the moonwalk.
He did?
He did indeed. And I tried to find out the origins of the moonwalk, and I'm not sure I did, but I did see a film with Cab Calloway.
I just saw this last night. When did he do the moonwalk?
In the cafe, he does the moonwalk. And I was watching a film of Cab Calloway that was done in 1932 where he does it, but not quite the same. You know, definitely it comes out of African-American culture. And somebody was asking on some website, did Michael Jackson learn this from Charlie Chaplin? Unlikely, except that Michael Jackson adored Charlie Chaplin and watched all of his movies. I'm sure he found it through black culture. But the first time I saw him do that, I thought, what? That's incredible.
Yeah.
So he himself may have been influenced by African-American popular actors, and I don't know that, but it certainly could be true.
So music, dance, singing, filmmaking
and
in every possible
ice
way.
Ice skating, blindfolded, next to
a roller skating.
Roller skating blindfolded, next to a part of the department store where if he falls off the edge, he's dead. And he does. And it really is a kind of metaphor for the U.S. going into the, you know, how close we live to the abyss in lives as, you know, lives like his, where he mostly just has to react and try to stay alive and keep his spirit going. It's a phenomenal scene.
I know. You're watching it falling off the edge of your couch.
Exactly.
And did he really film scenes like that without safety?
I don't know, actually. I tend to doubt it.
I doubt it.
I don't know how that scene was filmed, but it certainly looks as though at any moment he can fall over the cliff.
Right.
Which, of course, is a metaphor for his whole life. He has to live on the edge constantly and have his wits about him all the time. I mean, he's a very luck and pluck kind of American character, even though he's dressed in more English kind of dress with the bowler hat. But he, you know, at the end when he says, buck up, you know, that's a very kind of American idea that somehow through your own resiliency and personal resourcefulness, you can outwit the big guys. You can outwit Big Brother and the monster machine. And of course, most people can't do that. But I think it's very, if not unique to our culture, very much a part of our culture to identify with an underdog who has that much ingenuity and gets away with it.
And at the end, they walk into the
sunset.
Into
the sunset, a Hollywood ending.
Which is West.
Yes,
walking
it is,
West,
dear.
Is our mythology.
Go, it is our mythology. Yeah. Absolutely.
Lois Rudnick is Professor Emerita of American Studies at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. And we have talked on this program about immigration history, about Mabel Dodge Lujan, about art history.
I'm very eclectic.
Yes, you are. And it's all American studies in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And it's all cultural history. Charlie Chaplin, the movie Modern Times, is going to be shown 3 times at the CCA, December 29th and 30th at 12:30. And then January 2nd. At 6 in the evening, and you will be doing your Q&A after the film.
And an introduction to the film.
And an introduction on the 2nd of January.
Yes.
And so this is all part of the big Charlie Chaplin Holiday Festival at the CCA. Lois Rudnick, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Randall Marco. He does community relations and ordinance enforcement for the City of Santa Fe Environmental Services and Solid Waste Division. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So this basically means we're talking about, above all, recycling. Is that correct?
Recycling, any trash issues people may have, whether it's business or in their home. Anything that has to do with the state, the city, or the county within the city limits. So everything I do is within the city limits.
And so what kind of, I mean, we all have our little plastic bins and all of that, and we try to put our cans in them, and we don't really know what we're supposed to put in there and not, and we kind of look at the instructions, but the instructions change over the years and stuff like that. What actually should we be recycling, and what is getting recycled in Santa Fe in terms of residential? What goes in, and then where does it go?
Well, there are 2 bins that everybody can have at their home within the city limits. 1 bin is for glass only, and it could be multicolored glass, any colored glass. We encourage people to screw the tops off because most of the tops are either tin or aluminum, and in that case, they can go in the 2nd bin. But in the 1st bin, it's glass only. In the 2nd bin, it can be newspapers, aluminum, tin, plastic, mixed paper, white paper, newspaper, magazines, junk mail.
But not yogurt containers.
Well, I'll get to that. So, again, all those things can go into that bag, into that 2nd container.
Right.
When you talk about yogurt containers and you look at the bottom of the cup, it'll have a number, and that number can be from 1 to 7.
And it's usually 1 for the yogurt.
You know, most likely we would take it. But usually yogurts are anywhere from 4 to 7 because it's a different type of plastic.
Oh, okay.
But usually the water bottles are number 1. Your Tide containers are a number 1 or a number 2. So all that recycling gets picked up by our trucks.
And we're only supposed to put in numbers 1 and 2, right?
Well, 1 and 2 for now.
Yeah.
Hopefully later we'll be able to do it because we don't have a way to separate out those 3 through 7s.
Right.
But we do know how to separate out the clear plastic from the colored plastic 1s and 2s. So that's not a problem. So all that material goes to the transfer station. The glass gets picked up by 1 truck, and that truck goes to an area at the transfer where they dump it on the ground, and then there's big tractors that scoop it up, and they crush it into a finer sand. The other gets put into the interior of the building where it can be separated. And what happens is they dial in the separator, let's say, to do plastic. And the separator will run all the material through, kick out what's left, and actually bale the plastic. And then we can run the cardboard through, and we can run the tin through, and we can run the aluminum through, and we can run the colored plastic through. So all those things get recycled and sold on the open market, depending on the price of the commodity when it's sold at that time.
Now, what is the market for a bunch of old crushed-up Tide bottles?
Well, let me give you the best commodity, which is the cardboard.
Okay.
Because that one I'm more familiar with. And cardboard right now is $40 a ton. So those big bales usually are a half a ton. So each of those are about $20. At one time, cardboard was up over $100 a ton, when the peak of the economy was rolling along. And in 2008, when the economy went down, the price of commodities went down. Just like copper would go down or aluminum would go down, the price of cardboard would go down, the price of plastic would go down, or tin would go down. So that varies on the marketplace. And there, those other, you know, aluminum, tin, plastic, and paper account for about 40% of what we get, and about 60% of what we get that's the best commodity is the cardboard.
That's so interesting. And what happens to it?
Well, again, it gets crushed and baled and put to the side. And when they fill up a tractor trailer full of cardboard, it gets hauled away and it gets sold for whatever that commodity is going for at that time.
Right, but what happens to it after that? Do we know?
Well, it gets recycled back into usually the same product.
Ah, okay. So cardboard becomes cardboard.
Right. Plastic sometimes becomes insulation for, let's say, a jacket. Or it becomes little doublets, for another process down the road. So it eventually becomes something else down the road. Aluminum becomes aluminum down the road.
Yeah, aluminum is apparently highly recyclable. Aluminum can becomes another aluminum can, whereas a Tide bottle doesn't become another Tide bottle.
It could. It could become a bumper on a car.
Right.
It could become anything. But aluminum will become aluminum over and over and over again. Glass will become glass over and over and over again. The commodities are being recycled. And we'd like the public to know that, we're not throwing anything into the landfill that's recyclable. We're recycling everything.
Well, that's one of those urban legends that goes around, which is, you put it in the recycling bin, but it actually goes into the trash.
I get the call that says, I just saw him put everything in the same truck. Yes, sir, that's where it's supposed to go because it has separate containers, and when it gets dumped in separate parts of the truck, and when it gets taken to the land, the transfer station, it gets put in different parts of that facility. So, yes, it all goes in the same truck, but it becomes different.
Now, what about businesses? We're talking about residential and all the things we eat and use and going to the bins. But what about, there's so much business waste. Does that get recycled?
Well, right now there are 540-ish businesses that recycle. Of those, about 90 or so recycle cardboard. We pick up over 2,400 trash containers for businesses. So there's a big lag within the businesses themselves. If the business is new, and this is one of my main jobs, if the business knew that if they do a really good job of recycling, they can do away with trash pickup, a day of trash or 2 days of trash or 3 days of trash. And some are doing a great job, but most don't know. So you take, let's say, cardboard service at maybe $60 and you for a once-a-week pickup on a monthly service, and you take a trash pickup at $120 or $130 a month for that one day, and let's say they have 6 days of service, and they say to them, if you recycle at $60, you can save 3 days of trash per week per month. So you're saving over $300 versus $60. So that's where
it's an incentive that you put in place to really encourage them to recycle.
Right. We lowered our recycling rates, to reflect all this different cost going on. And that's one of my jobs, is to go in and not just talk to them about how they can recycle at the end product when it's outside where we pick it up, but how their goods flow, meaning the cardboard flows or the plastic flows or the tin flows within that business. Let's say it's a restaurant which has deliveries all the time, that say if you do the cardboard and you do the recycling of the plastic bottles and the tin and do away with 2-3 days of service, this is your savings per month. And it's usually a pretty sizable savings. Yeah.
So how do you reach out to businesses, or how can they reach out to you to get more involved in the city's recycling programs?
Well, I'm very easy to get a hold of, and my phone number is 955-2228. I'll repeat it again. If people are driving, please don't write this down. 955-2228. And call me anytime during the working week and the working hours, and I will be glad to come out to your business and assess, the type of trash you're throwing away, versus the type of recycling you could be doing, and link it to how much you could be saving every month. In the case of people doing 6 day a week pickup on trash and doing no recycling, the chances are we can do away with 2 or 3, or sometimes 4 days of service on the trash going to the recycling, which is a big savings for businesses. So I would encourage all you business owners to call me, and I'll be glad to come out, talk with you, set you up, get you going, follow up with you, come inside the business and see how the flow of those goods are going in the way of recycling. And again, 955-2228.
That's 955-2228. And you can call anytime, ladies and gentlemen. And so it's basically doing environmental good. It's helping the city. It's helping the larger community.
Right.
And it's helping people to save money.
Right. I mean, if a business can save, you know, $300 or $400 a month, I mean, maybe they can hire another employee. You know, I mean, I don't know the, you know, nature of the business, but I know the nature of how the recycling works.
Right.
And it's really important. I mean, you could, if you're in a big building, let's say with 15 or 20 small businesses in that big building, we can still set you up for recycling, and you can still do usually a really good job of it, because in those offices, there's usually paper and magazines and newspapers, and people may get deliveries of cardboard. So it's the same as if you were in a retail situation.
So you're up at this recycling facility. Does it smell bad?
Well, actually, it doesn't.
Really?
Actually, you'd be surprised. You know, cardboard has its own smell, and people kind of know it. But when you get these mountains of recycling, you're kind of awestruck because there's not a big smell that comes out like it would be for trash.
Right.
Or food waste or anything like that. There's no decomposition going on.
Do you let people go up there and check it out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if people wanted to bring, let's say they did a move or they had a party and they had a lot of cardboard and different types of recycling, they can go to that facility for free. And there's these big bins and they're very well marked, and you can put your recycling in and just drive away. You don't have to check in at the front desk or anything like that unless you're carrying trash or you're carrying a tree, you know, limbs or anything like that. But if it's recycling, it's free. And as you drive into the transfer station, it's right on the left, and it's really easy.
Do you ever get school groups going up there?
They go up there all the time, and there's a woman named Lisa Merrill that gives great tours up there in the facility. If anybody would like to get her number, please call me. And again, my number is 955-2228. That's 955-2228.
I think we've given the phone number more than enough.
We look forward to hearing from everybody.
Randall Marco does community relations and ordinance enforcement for the City of Santa Fe Environmental Services and Solid Waste Division. He's our recycling king. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Pleasure to be here.